some light snowfall as well. Currently, wind is from the south at 8, 24 degrees, Kenosha 23 in Racine. For WGTD.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, and I think you'll enjoy them both. One is with Wisconsin-born writer Michael Perry. The other is an intriguing look at some fun questions answered, such as what makes a curveball curve? Stay with us. And here's part one of today's program. In the many, many years that I have been doing WGTD's morning show, I count among the greatest pleasures the opportunities I've had to speak with Wisconsin author Michael Perry. We've talked about several of his wonderful books, including Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time, Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace, Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting, and Truck, A Love Story. We have talked about all of these books, and now we're going to be talking with Michael Perry about his latest book, which is called Parallels and Distinctions Between Himself and His Life, and that of an essayist by the name of Michel de Montaigne, who is well known to those who explore such works as one of history's earliest and most. And it is just fascinating, first of all, to get to know the writing of Montaigne, born in the mid-16th century, and to experience the utter timelessness of so much of what he says, or the acute relevance, and then, of course, to experience that through the wonderful writing of Michael Perry. The book is published by HarperCollins, and Michael Perry, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the morning show.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
So I have to say that this is actually a name I only had the vaguest acquaintance with, that is Michel de Montaigne, before reading your book, and I'm quite certain that I, at least on purpose, have never read anything by him before. So I'm grateful for the introduction through your wonderful book. Explain to our listeners your own introduction to this early essayist, how you've
kept coming up. And so I started to look into it, and what it was this 16th century nobleman who had written essays about being afflicted with kidney stones. And so when I finished the article, I started reading more and more of him, and that was my official introduction.
And you now, over the course of time, have not only read a great deal of his works directly, but you've also read a whole lot of books about him. Help us understand where he stands sort of in the history of essay writing and his importance, his significance.
Well, it's widely agreed, although not completely agreed. Nobody agrees on everything anymore, but it's pretty widely accepted that he invented the personal essay. And by that, I mean, he would write about anything. He was very learned. He was a nobleman. He was born to great privilege, retired at the age of 38 to sit in his castle tower and meditate. And when he found out he wasn't very good at just thinking, he started scribbling down his thoughts to keep track of them, write an entire essay about his thumb. He wrote pieces about marriage. He wrote pieces about flatulence. He really would go just about anywhere.
What seems to be sort of a flavor of self-deprecation and a little bit of a spirit of hesitancy. That is, he writes with beautiful flow about, as you have already said, a wide array of different topics and subjects, and yet in so much of what he writes, you tell us, there is this air of, I'm not fully sure of this, but I think maybe this is true. Sort of a spirit of humility that seems to flavor a lot of what he writes. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I think I somewhere in the book I said one of the reasons I love what he does is that he's willing to say I could be wrong. He's always willing to offer a caveat, and as such, I dedicated the book to those who approach conversation with something less than a steamroller. And I think, you know, I, speaking personally, at this particular juncture in our history, you have a great hunger to discuss something with someone and perhaps not even be in agreement, but to attempt to learn something from the other person as opposed to whack them into submission. And yes, he was very much certainly into some equivocation, but also just open to different ideas and open to the idea that he would lay out what he thought about something, but then say, but I could be wrong. And as I said, even in writing this book, I'm trying to operate under the auspices of exploration rather than declaration.
Hmm. Something else you say about him in terms of his relationship to you and the kind of writing that you have done for many, many years. You say at one point, because I want to live as a freelance writer, and a freelance writer must produce copy, I offer things in print I would never offer in conversation. And then you quote Montaigne as saying, amusing notion, many things that I would not want to tell anyone, I tell the public. And for my most secret knowledge and thoughts, I send my most faithful friends to a bookseller.
That he started out as a Stoic, both little s and big s, and his goal was to learn how to die a noble death. And then he had a kidney stone, and he realized, well, some things physical just take away your nobility no matter how hard you try. And he was living in the age before Percocet and Toradol medications. But he wanted to be this Stoic person, and yet he would reveal all these things about himself, including his weaknesses. And I relate to that, and that I'm a Stoic Scandinavian. I don't want to talk about my feelings, and you can't make me. But I wound up in a profession where I have to write things and tell them if I'm going to pay for the kids' braces. And so at 3 a.m., you're under the duress of not finishing a piece and not knowing how you're going to get someone to publish what you write, and the kids are asleep and you're not sure how you're going to take care of them. And so you open up your, because you're at a very nice literary event signing books, and some gentleman comes up and asks about a very personal condition you have. And I looked at the guy and just said, how do you know that? And he said, well, you wrote about it. And my response was, well, I shouldn't have.
And yet you did. And we're glad you did.
And yet I did.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author Michael Perry, whose latest book is called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. This is his exploration of the fascinating writings of 16th century essayist Michel de Montaigne. It's so intriguing the way in which his writing seems kind of an embodiment of who you are, especially as a writer.
Well, probably the best way to describe it is from the opening of the essay, which I describe. I say that Michel de Montaigne died in 1592 and was therefore unable to attend the Augusta Bean and Bacon Days Demolition Derby in 2013, which is a shame because my daughters and I attended and we had a wonderful time. But then I go on to explain that 2 days prior to that, we also attended the Shakespeare Festival at a university in Minnesota. And from there, I just talk about the idea that we seem to want to put ourselves into these divided camps, that you're either into the demolition derby or you're into the Shakespeare plays. And Montaigne was the kind of guy who encourages me to live in both worlds, that talk about trying to show my daughters that cultural consumption can be enjoyed on a sliding scale, including down there where it's greasy. And Montaigne really helped me explore that. And I don't even like the terms high culture and low culture, because you're applying a designation that perhaps you're not qualified to apply, and you're also implying things. But for the sake of shorthand, I enjoy both worlds, and Montaigne really helped me explore that.
Mm. Later in this chapter, you offer some really, I think, intriguing observations about the world of the internet in which we now all live and are with which we're trying to contend. And I think your observations are absolutely right on target. You say at one point, the internet and social media in particular is the ultimate intersectionality catalyst. Voices previously unheard are amplified. And later in that same paragraph, you say, we find ourselves interwoven in unexpected ways. You can't hide like you used to. I really appreciate the way in there, in terms of the way in which we can come to understand the way we are connected with each other, even with people who at a glance seem to be utterly different from us. Can you say more about that?
Yes, I certainly go to great lengths to make it clear that I understand the horrific cesspool of commentary that is out there, and certainly what it is like, for instance, to be a woman on the internet and say something. I talk about a sociologist that I've come to know through the internet and the abuse that she endures for making statements and for sharing her research, and yet what I cherish about her is that here is an academic sharing research on Twitter in such a way that a knucklehead like me stumbles across it, and it changes my thinking. And so I'm trying to explore that idea that while there's great horror out there on the internet, and I don't in any way mean to minimize that, on the other hand, it has allowed a guy like me, writing in a little room over a garage in rural Wisconsin, to strike up a dialogue with a Cuban American writer living in Brooklyn, and has taught me some things that I think I needed to learn, and it has put me in dialogue with, as I said, a woman who's a sociologist at a university I've never attended, and yet I can learn from her, and I can also vicariously experience what her life experience is like, and when filtered properly, I think, hope that social media does have some power to generate empathy.
Hmm. And I love how you talk about how so often in these kind of arenas, such as in social media, there is this real tendency for most of us to be, in your words, ferociously impatient. And there is this hunger to respond immediately and in the clearest of terms. And you say you see the world differently than you do. You want to experience what somebody calls the tension of difference. And again, this is intriguing because in some respects, it's a little bit at odds with who you are in terms of the way you tend to interact with the people in your world, at least, you know, in spoken conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I keep, matter of fact, even during this discussion that we're having, I'm enjoying the fact that you're doing a great job of pronouncing the name of the gentleman in question properly, whereas I'm from Chippewa, Wisconsin, and I say Montaigne, and I talk about that in the book, about how you should pronounce the name. And so I do find myself often in unexpected conversational situations, whether it's online or whether it's down at the feed mill. And in the end, I just keep coming back to the idea that Montaigne taught me that, well, maybe I can learn something from this conversation, and I'm going to do my best. I don't mean to say that we can all just be, you know, at some point you do have to make a decision. At some point you do have to take a stand. But yes, social media has sort of created this environment where you're expected in a split second to favorite something or like something or tear something down.
I'm guessing has generated an exceptional amount of attention is the fourth chapter of the book titled Shame, in which, among other things, you talk about sex. Although it's interesting, you take nine pages 81 to page 90, to basically talk about. I wonder if you could just say a word about the extent to which Michel de Montaigne has written about this and how his attitudes reflect your own.
Well, he was much less reticent than I. He wrote about it in great detail and in many different facets of sex. He was happy to talk about impotence and performance, and he saw it definitely as a source of great humor. He was very good at making fun of men and how they swagger about, but in the end they were these rather weak and delicate creatures. Scholars have noted that his attitudes about women and sex were interesting, and that in some ways he was classically, in part just because my mom's still alive, and not only me, but a few people around me, a little bit of difficulty.
By the way, I also really appreciated, because it so resonated with me, when it comes to, in general, bodily functions. You say, my circumspection in sexual matters was a full-on burlesque compared to my reticence regarding bodily functions. This is odd in that, as a farm boy, I spent my formative years standing, sometimes barefooted, in manure. And as a nurse, I dealt with every imaginable secretion. And the hangover continues.
This is funny because we're circling back in real time to something you already mentioned. I'm remembering some of the things I wrote in this book and going, oh my gosh, what was I thinking?
Well, and what's interesting in this chapter, you know, as amusing as much of it is, the really secret, the central matter is that of shame. And you say, I'm attempting to refine my understanding of shame, its power, and its paralysis. And you actually end up... But this is important to you.
Yeah, it started out as a religious thing, the way that I was raised, and then, you know, that doesn't preclude it for most folks. And in my teen years, I never started, and I think crusade. And then I think I wrote in the book about there was a time when I was dealing with some fairly severe depression, where one day I decided I just wanted to try drinking just so that I could have a day off from the worry and the concern. And while I was having that thought, I was walking upstairs to my little office where I wrote in the house where I lived at the time. And when I stepped into that office, it was ankle deep in candy and ho-ho wrappers and empty coffee cups. And I hadn't been out of the house for about a week. And I thought, you know, I think you probably shouldn't start.
I also really appreciate the candor of the next chapter called Marriage, in which you spell out all kinds of reasons why, in your words, life with me can be miserable. You eventually begin exploring the matter of your kind of emotional state and the fact that there are things about you emotionally and mentally that are, in some respects, we might say, fragile, and that you are prone to swings of mood that you're probably still trying to sort of sort out. And even as you talk about, for instance, the way in which sometimes you seem to sag into a state of depression, that you're very reluctant to necessarily assign that term to yourself or talk about it, not out of embarrassment, but I think for other reasons. Can you talk for a moment about this reality in your life and the great care with which you explore it and talk about it?
Well, the reticence there comes from a couple of things. One is just that blue-collar stoicism that I spring from. The other is being surrounded by people who really are struggling with profound challenges, whether they're economic, whether they're personal. And so that when I am feeling depressed, I don't feel like I have really much cause to complain about it when there are so many others suffering so much more. On the other hand, I've also watched as this predisposition to keep things quiet and to tough it out has injured folks. And so that's why I open up about it a little bit. And I talk about my brother, the logger, who nobody's tougher than he is. But we both share some anxiety and depression issues, him to a much greater degree. And I just felt like that was my little contribution to saying, hey, these things are there's something that we do.
You live in a kind of a zone of gray, and it's maybe not always that we hear from those particular, but we talk in this particular interview about his memoir called The Longest Trip Home. And on Friday, Joe Luizzo and Elazar Aslan